does with Anya,
American. When you watch cinema, you're looking for a vision of what life can be. Right. We need to repurpose the idea of the studio picture towards a bigger vision of the future within this type of film.
All right, cool. Well, let's jump into our main segment this week. And I'm stoked because I get to welcome in a new friend of mine that I have recently met over the last couple of months here and signed up to do some artistic madness with him. Isaiah Medina, welcome to the show, brother. How are you?
I'm doing great. Having a nice day. So how are you?
Doing all right, man. Doing all right. So for people who have not seen your previous film, don't know about you, give us a little bio. Who are you? What do you do? Why are you on this podcast?
I make movies. In 2015, I made my first feature called 8888.
Which, by the way, I got to say, whenever I talk with people, it seems that so many people are confused if it's 8888 or is it 8888? Is that?
I mean, during the festival run, I always called it 8888. But now that's done, for some reason, I've been saying 88 just because, you know, quicker. But it really doesn't matter. I mean, that's the idea, is that, like, I mean, there's no need for translation when we do the title, you know, because you just come and see it. It's numbers. It's not like, you know, when you see like a French title for an American film or see like a completely different title, but we don't run into that problem with the title of this movie.
Yeah.
So it's something like that. It's like, yeah, whatever, how you want to say it, because you just kind of see the number. You don't have to really say it out loud.
We need like an anti-Pythagorean culture that doesn't use numbers, and that will be difficult.
Yeah. So what's the deal behind 8888? Why the title?
I mean, it came from like when you're unable to pay your bills and say your heat gets cut, your electricity gets cut, your water gets cut, all these type of things happen to you. And then once you're able to pay your bills again, because you've been living in darkness, the digital clocks in your home could flash 8888. Like, because that's what, it's kind of like the, like, yeah, when all the parts are kind of lit up, which is 8888. So I just thought, like, this would be, because this happened to me a lot growing up. So it was like an image that kind of stuck with me. And the idea is also that if you kind of look at it sideways, it's kind of like the infinity symbol. So I wanted to relate the idea of, say, your lights getting cut and your water getting cut, and to think around the cut, because in cinema, usually the discourse is around the image or sound, but I think I want to emphasize the primacy of the cut rather than the image, because no matter what happens with technology, whether we're shooting with a chemical basis in film or in digital, there's something invariant about the cut, that it doesn't... like the materialism of cinema is in the immateriality of the cut. So I want to think this notion of the cut in relation to poverty, because in like a sort of classical Western tradition of thought, the great systems start with nothing. Like when you think of Socrates, all I know is I know nothing, or Descartes with the cogito proof, or Hegel with being and nothing, or Badiou with the void. There's a starting point and nothing. And I thought we could translate the experience of poverty, which is a type of phenomenological experience of nothing, and montage that idea with this other idea of nothing with philosophy, so that even in poverty, you can have a beginning of thought.
Now, before that, you had made a sort of string of shorts, right? That gained some notoriety online through, what was it, through YouTube and through Vimeo, or was it all through YouTube?
I mean, yeah, my first short, I was like 18 at the time. It was called Semi-Other Colors. And like what happened was it actually played at like the Center George Pompidou. So I went there and showed it. And I just showed like a bunch of festivals and like museums. And after that, I just thought, oh, I should just put online. And then I put on Tumblr and stuff, and just people saw it, and I made friends with people on Tumblr and stuff. And then we just talked about cinema. And then, like, I was hanging out with my friend Alex a lot in Montreal, and we just kind of – so during the student strikes in Quebec in, like, 2012, you just, we just wouldn't be in class for many, many months. We're stories into protests. So at the same time, but the library is open, so you could still read and do things like that. And once school kind of got, you know, like Marwar got voted in, But, and the tuition freeze happened for a bit and kind of came back. But it just felt kind of kitsch to go back to class after all that. So
right.
Alex and I just kind of hung out and made movies all the time and just like dropped a bunch of shorts that year and just put it on YouTube. And just kind of, yeah, we just like would like watch philosophy lectures at home and skip class and then shoot stuff and just make stuff and just theorize and think about stuff and put it online. And then, yeah, and I guess people watched it.
Right on. So then, so 88 gets released in 15. It premieres at Locarno, which is in Switzerland. It plays TIFF. It plays New York Film Festival. And it got pretty much, you know, stellar reviews. Obviously, there's always going to be criticism and whatnot. Yeah. So what I guess, is the next step? So that film is done. And then what have you been working on since that film?
Well, I have some other projects going on right now too, but I don't think I'll talk about that too much today. It's all kind of on the
right.
Gotta keep some things secret. But I mean, I think I told you about it before, but I just don't know if you're talking about the podcast. But since we're kind of inventing the future now, it just seemed that it was a nice transitory step from thinking the notion of poverty towards like a notion of UBI and post work. So it just seemed like you wouldn't make a second film about poverty in a way, you know?
Right.
You try to think something else. And if the last film tried to think, you know, how beginning occurs, was like the figure of nothing or like the restarting symbol of the 8888. So it's related to like the thought of the beginning is the beginning of thought type of idea. This idea that we're thinking of transition and, you know, post-work, post-capitalism, UBI. So it just seemed that the connection from thinking the beginning and now thinking theories of transitions was like the right step.
Yeah, it was kind of a perfect marriage. When I read the book, I read it and, you know, I know Nick and Alex from conferences over the years. And when I read the book, I knew that there had to be some sort of artistic collaboration. It just kind of jumped off the pages at me. And I think also this idea of a universal basic income, it's so interesting because the book was published at the tail end of 2015. Mm-hmm. And since then, I'd say in the last year and a half now, or just we'll say even in the last 10 or so months, the idea of a basic income has been talked about in public by figures like Elon Musk. Thomas Piketty has been writing about it on his blog lately. And then, of course, there's the French presidential candidate. What is it? Hamon? Is that who it is? I think it was. Who was actually running as an advocate. The one who was the socialist candidate who took over for Hollande. He was actually running on the platform of a universal basic income.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting that this idea has garnered so much attention. And now there are all of these sort of pilot programs all around the world, from various cities in the Netherlands to Scotland to places in Canada. And then there are some weird ones in the United States where they're like a basic income, but they're not government funded. They're private funded.
Yeah.
So, but there are all these things going on around the world and it's really interesting. So I just felt like the book, it just seems so fucking timely. That it should be having. Troy, did you finish? You were reading the book for a while. Did you finish it?
Yeah, I finished it last year.
Last year, that's right. Okay. What did you think when you read the book?
Yeah, I mean, I was coming in after all this stuff had been into the blogosphere and the Twitter sphere. And so I was aware of all the arguments, but seeing it all together and the critique of folk politics and everything else, it really kind of encapsulates all those different issues that are sometimes seen separately into one vision, which I think is more important than anything, seeing it as one cohesive vision and alternative to what's currently happening.
Yeah.
Especially in like, you know, liberal politics.
Yeah. I think the thing I like about it is they talk about it as though the demands that they make, because they make four demands in the book, right? One is full automation. One is universal basic income. The third is a shortening of the work week. And then the fourth is the eradication of the, I guess we'd say the capitalist exploitative work ethic. Yeah. And when you take those things individually, you know, there was just that that there was some British politician, I can't remember who it was, but that was giving shit to the Green Party because they were saying that they demand a 3-day work, a 3-day weekend. And he's like, oh yeah, Green Party, while you're at a 3-day weekend, why don't we do this and this and this and that? And everything that he mentioned was very reasonable.
Yeah.
It was all very like you look at it and you're like, yeah, a 3-day weekend, is that the craziest thing in the world to suggest? No. Yeah. But in, I think individually, you know, it's like, no, full automation. We want robots, everything, robots and everything should be automated. That might sound a little crazy. And then, oh, a universal basic income. Everyone just gets a flat thing, but there's also still social protections at the same time. Because, you know, libertarians, they're cool with – some libertarians are cool with a basic income as well, as long as you cut all government spending, right? So that's not what they argue for. And then, of course, the idea of the shortening of the work week and the eradication of the work ethic. And all four of those things together are kind of inflammatory topics, but the way that they encompass it into one sort of counter-hegemonic image, it actually is very reasonable. It doesn't seem crazy. It doesn't seem like some sort of, I don't know, entitled, spoiled, millennial demand or whatever the hell the critics might kind of say. Right. It just, it seems like, no, this is an alternative political program that is entirely feasible and is probably something we should at least kind of tend towards in our sort of imaginative projections as images that can affect us and move us forward.
One question I have is, given that you guys are working on this documentary, a little birdie told me this is not going to be a film buff myself. I don't know what the term is for a documentary that basically is just purely informative. Is there a technical term for that?
A talking head documentary.
Okay. That works for me. Yeah. It's not going to be a talking head documentary.
And what we mean by that is it's not going to be a bunch of experts who are just sitting there saying, all right, this is why we need to have a post-work world or, you know, the virtues of communism are such, it's not going to be that sort of academic informational type of film.
Yeah, here's David Harvey, here's Piketty,
right.
here's Bernie Sanders. Yeah, given that what I'm interested in talking about a little bit myself, not being involved in the whole project and not having done film myself, one thing I really enjoy about philosophy and film together is usually when those two fields are brought together, it's for philosophy to talk about film.
Right.
Or to use film as a means to its own ends.
Right.
Sort of, so film becomes the midwife of philosophy. And I kind of hate that. I mean, it's fun for its own purposes, but it doesn't really treat film as being an independent actor,
right?
No pun intended. So one thing I like thinking about is how you can make film that's philosophical without being representational. So a film that sort of, you think of like J.L. Austin's, you know, How to Do Things with Words, speech acts, and that kind of thing. Mm. Why couldn't we talk about film acts?
Well, this
how to do things with films.
Yeah, this is precisely what John Malarkey's book, Refractions of Reality, talks about. And he comes at it from the perspective of Laruelle, where he wants to reject that idea of the principle of sufficient philosophy that you were just talking about, that whenever philosophy and film come together, it's always philosophy of film, and philosophy has precedence, right? And in Malarkey's book, or in a sort of Laruellian paradigm, what he's doing is he wants to say that no, that actually film is a type of thought itself. Just like philosophy is a type of thought, science is a type of thought, mathematics is a type of thought, and they're all equal before the real. And so film actually has a communicative impetus that is autonomous in itself, that has its own uniqueness. And actually, I mean, Isaiah, it's funny, he hadn't read Malarkey's book, but when he talks, I'm like, oh, you already think like that. Like, he already comes at filmmaking from that perspective. And then I think he just kind of skimmed over some of the bits. Yeah. And he was totally vibing with it, because it's exactly, Troy, what you were just saying is kind of what Malarkey's book talks about, and I think kind of where Isaiah's head already was.
Yeah, that's my question, is how in the world do you do this with an issue that's very detailed and analytical like Inventing the Future is? I mean, I know you just don't want to give away the whole format of the whole thing, what's going to happen, but what can you tell us about how this is going to work?
I mean, when it comes to thinking cinema, I just think it's important that it wasn't immediately valued as an art form. And that's like a positive moment, that we didn't see a projected image and be, oh, it's art. You know, there was always like a fight to make it among the arts. But at the same time, I feel like even now, 100 or so years later, we don't have to rush into that either. It could be something else. And like, say, in the sense of how Badu organizes his philosophy around the conditions of truth of politics, science, love, and art. And I think cinema can think within that same type of form because it takes from all the arts, like theater, painting, poetry, whatever, but also could like take from the political moment or someone's love life or whatever, what's happening in the sciences. So, and you just organize all these type of ideas around the cut, you know? So, and then the cut is what kind of thinks the compossibility between these different truths at once, and you get to see it. Because the cut doesn't, because what I would say is the cut is not representing anything, like nothing appears. So when you're asking about how do you do cinema without it being like in the sense of representation, like perhaps sound, yes, perhaps the image, yes, but I think the cut is thinking of it in a different space. And that's why I always try to emphasize this idea of the cut, because in the cut, it's like, it's obviously a moment of change, but also it would be a moment of stasis because you could cut and nothing happens. But at the same time, you know, frame by frame is a sort of flicker to keep it, to keep the images consistent and have that intermittency. But like when you have a cut, the very form of change changes. Because when you're watching a film, it's always kind of flickering. You see something else and else and else. And when it's like a pure cut, we go somewhere completely different. So yeah, even the very form of change changes. And since we're thinking political change, I think to really go into the formal aspects of how cinema can think, and one of those forms of thinking in cinema is the cut, I want to focus on that as well as the frame and these type of things. Because yeah, like you were saying, like when you read people, I guess, using film as a condition for their philosophy, it's so rare to see someone talk about the form. They'll talk about the story and say, like, oh, look at this story of Terminator, and now I have the idea of hyperstition. You know, but do they, it's just like very rarely they talk about the frames or the cuts or what cinematic moves it makes. Because I think that, no matter what happens in the story, if the form is not at the level of cinema, then I could have just read the Wikipedia page. You know, like, what really is happening in a movie that could inspire a new form of thinking? And if it's just within the story, you never needed cinema to begin with. And I think that's why a lot of readings of cinema end up just talking about the story. Like, it's very rare when I read something to really talk about a camera move linking to this and that. And the thought itself comes from that. It's not like, oh, look, this thought happens here, but, oh, I think I read that in Hegel before. You know, but, like, it's just like when it's an actual new form of thinking being created by a collection of framing and cutting. So yeah, there's this type of idea I want to bring to invent in the future, because there's this nice thing that Lumiere, you know, the ones who invented like a camera that could shoot and project, they said cinema is the invention without a future. So I think this fatalism is important to think the future. You have to be at a sort of modernist space to say that, okay, we can't do anything, and because we can't do anything, we have to think something else.
Is there a sense in which the cut is a violence? It's sort of a creative destruction, if you will?
I mean, not necessarily, because like a cut separates and brings together within the same movement. You know, it's not just going to be a pure cut to nothing. It's going to be cut to something else. And you could, like, yeah, the cut is like a moment of playing with identity and difference within cinema. So it's not ever purely violent either. But it understands that something must go. You know, there's a thinking of negation in the cut. Because, like, yeah, you know, like, if we have, when we light the frame, for instance, we could be, like, in some sort of intuitionistic logic between P and non-P. So some things are in light, some things are not in the light, and they appear or don't appear. But the cut appears and disappears at the same time. So it's this type of paraconsistent logic that you work with. So we get to play with all these different forms of negation while watching movies. And I think those type of things need to be thought, because if you're trying to think the future, we do have to affirm something to negate as well. And that's not going to be simply at the level of narrative. Yeah, it's not just going to be at the level of narrative.
So it's got to be a formal exercise as well. It kind of reminds me of the sort of the Nietzschean idea that even in style there is substance.
Oh, totally.
And that's what's so crucial, is that so often we separate form from material tendency. And really, there is no. I mean, I'm a monist, so
yeah.
I think if you're going to commit yourself to radical immanence, which I do, then you have to reject difference of kind in some ways. And I ultimately do. I kind of just think everything is difference in degrees. And so in that sense, the difference between formality and sort of material instantiation or material tendency is a difference of position. It's a difference of context. It's the difference of enactment. They imbue one another and they co-constitute one another. And so a shift in one or a break in one is necessarily a shift or a break in the other. So when you're focusing on narrative, people, they aren't focusing on form, but they're still reproducing some banal sense of form. So like I just went to the movies yesterday and there's a great little art house cinema here in Dublin. That's the Irish Film Institute. And I didn't pick the film. My girl picked the film, but it was called The Secret Scripture. Have you guys heard about that?
No, never heard of it.
So it's like a romance kind of film, but you know, it's playing at this cool art house cinema and it's been getting pretty good reviews. And so I was like, all right, I'll check it out. It's directed by Jim Sheridan. So I was like, all right, you know, I'll give it a go. It's this cinema doesn't usually let me down and pick just total garbage, but it was basically a dark version of The Notebook.
Yeah.
You know, and I walked out and one of the reviews that they had on the poster was like elegantly crafted and expertly acted. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? It was the most bland direction, not that like I've ever seen, but it was like typical bland direction, shot, reverse shot, some handheld camera with, you know, wide angle lenses to increase intensity, close-ups on people's faces as they're walking on a beach with beautiful scenery. And I like that shit as much as the next person. Like Terrence Malick is one of my favorite directors, but I don't want to see everybody doing it. And I get tired of it. And it's that reproduction of those simple elements of form because they weren't paying attention to the form just because all they cared about was this story where I don't know. I think there's got to be some sort of shift between the two and people need to pay attention more to doing interesting shit. Like Troy and I actually were talking about this. Did you watch that video that I sent you about Edgar Wright, the Every Frame's a Painting?
Yeah, I did.
I mean, how fucking cool is that? Edgar Wright is such an interesting director. He can make a comedy about, you know, boys
going
getting back
bathroom.
Together. Going to the bathroom. Yeah. And he makes it interesting. And the way that he uses the cut, the way that he uses transition, the way that he uses sound, the way that he uses light, the way that he uses all the tools at his disposal is far more intriguing than just kind of the standard comedic filmmaker who isn't as concerned with form, but nevertheless, they're still reproducing some elements of formality. And I don't know, it just is kind of stale.
Yeah, I think what you were talking about with, like, I do think the shot reverse shot still has a sort of power if it is used within a space that it works. And like, I think the problem is also just like what you were talking about with this film was that there is automation already happening there, but like in a negative way, you know, yeah. Like the demand for full automation isn't just automate everything. At the same time, it's to also recognize the sort of weak forms of automation that already exist in art. You know, that there's something automatic about shooting a film that way today. And the question is not to get rid of automation, but how to, like, yeah, sort of redirect it into more interesting artistic forms.
Wait, when you say that, do you mean that there's a sense in which people have interiorized automation? And so when they make a film, there's a sort of a reproduction of that interiorization of automation?
Oh, yeah, the sale of a certain film language, a certain way of making a film, because that always kind of inevitably gets automated. That sort of happens. You know, like an artistic event can happen and all of a sudden it's normalized, but which is part of it. It's not like, ooh, against normalization. Like, the idea is that certain breakthroughs in art do get normalized and you have to, in the same sense that, like, there are higher infinities after that. There's not only one, so you think of another one again. So when you watch a film and you realize, oh wait, we're reaching this other point of automation, you have to invent another one. Because like auteurism really is this idea that, you know, with the Kaye critics and thinking of classical Hollywood, they're in a space of automation, like the automation of mass art. And then they're trying to find a way, oh wait, but the director, the auteur is a direction of where it's going. It's not simply, you know, mass commerce in that way too.
Yeah.
But I think to recognize that too, because I think it's crucial that one thing I was thinking about regarding inventing the future whereas like 88 and the other thing before was like done with no money and sort of like, I guess, you know, what they would call a passion project or whatever, and whatever I can do to do it. I like to think of Inventing the Future as a studio picture, you know, in that classical sense, you know, and not in a negative way either. I think there's a value in it.
Does that make me the cigar smoking fat cat studio producer?
No, but you know what I mean? Like, I think like when this idea of synthetic freedom in the book, how we don't just run from alienation and go back to, you know, immediacy in some way, you know, and I think studio picture is a form of alienation that we need to redouble and find a new path from and towards and invent another type of studio picture. Because in a studio picture, the idea is that you have someone working on this, someone working on that, someone working on this, you know, and you all work towards a common goal. And there might be, but there's a way to think that alienation without it being just like a negative trait. It does an enabling capacity to the fact we're alienated. You know, I don't think it has to necessarily be a negative thing. Like, I'd love to see, you know, avant-garde work produced within a studio environment. There's nothing like inherently negative about that. In the same way we're talking about repurposing capitalist technologies towards this, this and that, right, we need to repurpose the idea of the studio picture towards a bigger vision of the future within this type of film.
Right. I mean, you know? that Jew talks about the idea of the hope for a proletarian cinema, right?
Yeah.
A proletarian art. And one of the things I think that's interesting, something that I've written about previously, is that I think that even in a film like, let's say, The Notebook, since I was just talking about it, even in a film like The Notebook, there's still some sort of logic of freedom or some logic of transformation or some logic of affect that is embedded within it. Now, it might be clouded structurally under the sort of intentions or I should say the intensities or the variations of bourgeois art or suppressive art or whatever it is that's holding down the flows from being released. But nevertheless, the logic of freedom or the logic of transformation or the logic of the future or the logic of utopia or these different sort of imaginative images, it's still embedded. Again, if you're going to be a good monist, it's all there. It's just, you need to palpate the surface. I mean, this is something that Deleuze talks about. You have to palpate the surface to release the flows of difference so that they can express their lines of flight in sort of their free, unbounded potency. And even in a studio film, you have that. It's just about, it's about figuring out how to release the flows of difference.
I mean, that's what's the sort of liberatory aspect of like the Kaye critics praising Hollywood productions. You know, they could see that in the work there. And I think it goes back to the critique of the tradition of quality, you know, because it's not about whether something's good or bad. I'm just curious if it's cinema. That's what I care about. You know, like, I'll watch Notebook. There could be a cut or a shot or a scene or like a minute or a second or maybe 10 minutes. And if there's some idea of cinema there, I mean, it's like the idea of cinema is more important than any existing film, you know? Yeah. And I think sometimes you encounter it here and there in good or bad films. So I think the classic critique of traditional quality means that I don't care if it's good or bad. Like, there's probably like some moments I liked in The Notebook. I remember it was like some emotional things in that. Yeah. You know, when he just, I haven't seen in a while. I was like really young, but
the scene when they're out by the car and he's like, what do you want? Yo, that gets me. Okay.
Yeah, I'm totally. I mean, that's what I mean. Like this the idea of cinema, the sort of yelling or like yelling in the rain.
Yeah.
Blah, blah. And I think these are valuable ideas just in the sense that when you watch cinema, you're looking for a vision of what life can be, you know, because it looks so close and yet so far from what is being lived. And to apply that to Inventing the Future is a type of hyper-personal thing too, that if we're using the same materials of the present to imagine the future, it means that the future is already here in some sense. Yeah, so it's that type of thing. Yeah, like I'm more or less usually down to watch anything. It doesn't really matter. And that's part of the idea. But when you talk about like a proletarian cinema at the same time, it's like, I always like that Jameson quote about, in a society of like massive inequalities, we're okay with it as long as the rich are as vulgar as everyone else and enjoy vulgar things. But that means there's a genuine possibility of the proletarians reappropriating the notion of high art. And that's something I like to hold on to because, that's why I'd rather be surrounded with that. And there's nothing necessarily elitist. Like, it's like when Antoine Fité talks about like theater being elitism for all. Yeah, you know, it's like UBI for all. It's like, you know, this type of idea. It's not necessarily anything wrong about high art or these notions. But if you untie high art from totality, it could be something else, you know? So I think, and yeah, if all the reactionary tendencies are within politics and the arc they're into are just sort of, I guess, memes and Hollywood movies are not as interesting and they just focus on story. But, well, okay, fine. Let's just watch great films or something. Let's just try to think those type of things too and reclaim it for whatever political subject you want to name today. Like, I always disliked when people would think 88 is inaccessible to people. Hmm. The only people who say that are cinephiles. You know, like, if, like, high school students came up to me and, like, even younger, who really liked the movie and asked me about, oh, what's a good philosophy book to read, that I could really relate to this film, I just want to learn more about philosophy. And yeah, there's no actual divide. It's just a sort of fiction by, like, film critics who are just upset that we're reading philosophy at all. You know, so I don't like this sort of idea that, no, it's just, it's the coexistence is already there. To act like, oh, just because they're reading this or that, it's elitist now, or because they're cutting like that, playing with colors like that, not everyone will like it. But I just think it's just a pure false propaganda to be against a sort of way of thinking about art, especially if you're poor or colored or this or that. You know? Like, I feel no satisfaction in simply just, oh, you know, the person on screen looks like me too. Like, who cares? I honestly don't care. You know, that's whatever. But I'm more interested if we could think some new forms. That's the only thing that I feel connected to in a way. Because if it's a new form, then we're all the same before that new form because we haven't seen it yet. And I feel no simple satisfaction of being like, oh, I really wish we got this narrative story. Yeah, back to narrative. But if their skin was like mine, I'd like it more. Like, no thanks. You know, I just want to see a different way of looking at a face, a different way of cutting around it. And maybe the skin appears as something completely different too. So it's just these type of questions of just, and yeah, they always tie back to narrative and never to form in the same way.
Okay, so I have kind of a naive question. We've talked about some of the, what this kind of film can do and how it's different from this kind of more traditional representational kind of film. What would you guys say to the idea that taking something like Inventing the Future, which is inherently political and it's progressive and all these things, and then doing an artistic or avant-garde approach to it, a naive question might be, well, isn't that mean that no one's going to actually get the ideas behind it? If this isn't a vehicle for ideas, but is its own kind of separate goal in mind, then does anybody come out of this and say, yeah, I want to be a socialist?
I mean, I think it's difficult for that to happen in any film regardless. I think most socialists go into a film knowing they're socialists beforehand, you know? And the idea is not to reaffirm a subject that's already there, but to create something else. And I think only within these type of forms you can come to that. Because the idea too is that pretty simply cinema is not politics. And I think there's also a danger of always having all our politics only in art. And then you forget to do politics in other ways too, you know? So I think it's also just to also just enjoy art for what it is or enjoy a movie for what it is because, yeah, there's so much to say, like, if we talk about, I don't know, like, if all our politics depends on who wins Oscars and that, then once the Oscars go well, then our politics is done. You know what I mean? Like, it shouldn't all just be around the cultural sphere. But at the same time, what can culture and art do? It can think new forms of beauty. And beauty has its own relation to thought that we have to think. That's unthinkable within the book Inventing the Future. Like, what can we learn about beauty from Inventing the Future? You know? So to assist a political project like that, perhaps it's almost ideal to think about new forms of beauty for the future too. And it's not, yeah, and it may not be like an exact direct line to do it, but it is a part of the political project of the future too. So I think that, like, if you come away with an idea of what it looks like or what can be like, that sort of relation to it can be important too. Because yeah, if we really just want to like, oh, turn something socialist, okay, then we should just do a talking head documentary. But it probably wouldn't even be cinema anymore. It'd just be like a bunch of people talking about like, hey, do this. But people who watch that movie will probably already agree with it, you know? But with
exactly
art.
Exactly right. Yeah.
But with art, like, okay, this is like a somewhat silly example, but not really. I mean, most of my sort of quote unquote progressive friends, they love Clint Eastwood, for instance. And I think that's because like they think they like, to, I, like personally, I don't really care for his work that much. I mean, I could watch it, whatever, but really, I don't have to really talk about Clint Eastwood. But the idea is that, like, I like Bridges in Madison County. That's just another story. But the idea is that certain divisions that exist in politics don't always exist in art. And that's something to take advantage of in a quote unquote political movie. You know, if a bunch of some left wingers watch, what's the last Eastwood film, Sully or this or that, and find something positive, that means there's already a minimal solidarity with people who might be right wing, and we could just figure a new collective subjectivity there on the basis of art. That if we shifted to politics, we might be complete enemies. But here in art, there's something we could agree on, so we should try to find out what that is. And I think that's what's important about, you know, and we should think about that when we're making a movie like this. Because like you say, a lot of people only write art for UBI, you know? So the idea is how to work with their collective fantasies of what that life can be too, and work with these ideas on the aesthetic plane, rather than just being like making a movie for leftists. Mm-hmm. Then what, you know? Yeah. And it would be kind of sad if only Clint Eastwood could reach leftists, but leftists can't reach right-wingers in our art forms. Like, is our art that weak? You know, right. is our art that weak that we already have our audience as a market, and that's the only market we know? You know, I think if art is universal, which I think when it is truly art, it is, then it actually does break down these sort of categories, you know?
And yeah.
Something to think of.
Yeah. And this is something too that William Connolly and that Deleuze talk about that I think fits in. And it's the idea that there are what I've termed micro psychobiological shifts that are constantly taking place when we're embedded or thrown into any material environment that is not of our own choosing. You know, the muffin that I eat or the loud noise outside my windows at night, all of those things are affecting me. And yeah. When you go to see a film that is sort of playing with the accepted phenomenological lived experience, it does sort of shift or initiate the phenomenological epoche, the reduction, right? And in that, there can be a power. It can rewire those shifts. It changes neuronal flows. And I don't mean neuronal simply in the biological sense, but I mean it more as a metaphor. It changes the sort of affective, emotive, phenomenological, psychological, material flows of your embodied consciousness, your embodied, enacted, extended, embodied consciousness. And it does change you. It can change you. Mm-hmm. And that's happening to us at all times. And so for me, I think one of the things that's interesting about high art or good art or transformative art or liberatory art, or maybe we could say transgressive art, is that if it's not one film, someone's not going to come into Inventing the Future and they're going to walk out converted like they had a Holy Spirit moment, you know? I mean, maybe. Fuck, if someone does, great. But that's not the point. The point isn't to have a sort of immediate radical conversion. It's about the perpetual transformation and reproduction of new forms of living, new forms of creating, and new forms of ways of being together. And so this film is an extension of your mind and your creative impetus that began with, you know, the first short film you said you made when you were, what, 18? Or maybe before then? And it's all an unfolding, if you will, of that. And there's always a sort of transformation in the unfolding. It's not a repetition of the same. It's a repetition of difference. And there's always a new transformative power or potency that is being expressed, that is being instantiated, and that is kind of like breaking down the compartments of lived experience and releasing the flows of life in different ways. And I think that's what this type of film does. It might not convert someone to socialism who otherwise is a hardcore Hayekian free market capitalist, but that's okay. That's okay. I mean, maybe the person's having a shitty day and the person can come to the cinema and they can see some beautiful fucking images and they can listen to some excerpts from a text and it can brighten up their moment. I mean, to me, that's powerful. Yeah. And that's important, yeah. Yeah. Right?
No, seeing beauty in your day is important, and there's not enough of it.
Exactly, and it's and I think we fetishize the singular event. And this is the one thing where I differ from a lot of French theorists. And even though my PhD research centered around Jean-Paul Sartre and you know, Badiou gets his idea of the event from Sartre in Critique of Dialectical Reasoning. So I'm very interested in the event or in the apocalypse, as Malraux talks about and Sartre picks up. But I prefer the sort of Deleuzean idea of the event, that events are everywhere, all the time. And we fetishize that singular event so much that it's about the one moment, that Christian conversion, that Pauline, I'm on the road to Damascus moment, rather than recognizing that it's about this firework chain of events that you are immersed in, that we aren't always aware of, that we need to figure out how to stimulate more of, and then figure out how the flows that are released from that, how they can be creative. And so for me, I fetishize the event too. I mean, trust me, but I'm put a gun to my head. I think that it's not, you know, it's not the best way to think, man. I think we got to think about events, plural, and they're all capital E events.
I mean, I'm probably all for the conversion in the sense that it's not so much being converted in the moment. It's like more just looking back and realize you're already converted and then like, it's not so much like, oh, there's a single event that you're converted at. Is that at one point you look and say, wait a minute, I was already converted. I'm already in the process. And we have to continue that process to be able to think.
Right.
You know, and I think, and the way I read Badiou is that since he writes, you know, there's different approaches to your event, like it's a faithful one, a reactive one, an obscure one, etc.
Yeah.
It's something like that. Like even if you're in obscure towards an event, you're still in it and you're already in the process. Like I think that's how I think his work, you're already in it, but you just have to find a way to wade through it. And I think the question of the conversion, like I've seen movies and I'm completely converted on the first screening. Hmm. I think there's nothing to be afraid of in that either. You know, like I feel like there's something very positive in just thinking, like, of course it relates to the other movies you've seen beforehand, all that type of stuff too, right?
Right.
But at the same time, when I watch a movie and I'm completely converted after the movie's done, I like relish it and I think, oh, I'm not gonna. Okay, wait, for instance, like when you know critics watch a movie sometimes and just like, I saw someone who tweet, like, oh, do we know it's a masterpiece when it happens? Or is it become a masterpiece like 5 years later and look back as a masterpiece? Hmm. I mean, I think the task is to claim the masterpiece now. Like, it's so easy to look back and be like, oh, you know, that was probably a masterpiece. Like, who cares if you can do that? You know? Hmm. The real task is to think the masterpiece in the present. You know, because in thinking the future, the idea is that if it's truly a masterpiece, if you're going to gamble and figure dice on such and such an artwork is a true masterpiece, then there's also this short circuit, because if our masterpiece is what it is, then it relates to eternity. And then we're already short circuit to the future, because this work will exist throughout time, you know? And that's like the sort of sensation I get when I watch like a truly great movie, that I also saw a glimpse of the future then. If this is truly a great work. And we shouldn't have anxiety towards that. We should embrace it and follow its processes to create other thoughts on that scale. Like, I know there's a contemporary thing in a lot of film culture to just be kind of wary of claiming there's great work that exists now or before or whatever, you know? But it's not an objective thing. It's a purely subjective work to make sure we can think this work of art as a consequence for our thinking. Hmm. And yeah, that's something that kind of bothers me today, that it's even like around in my generation, people are just so anti-masterpiece, or just as like an axiom for their thinking, that we're just not going to see anymore, or it just doesn't really happen. It's a, you know, it's an evil idea to begin with, blah, blah, blah. But I think it's so false. No, there's poems I've read as a kid and I love them now. And I feel like without thinking's relation to the eternal, what are we thinking about? And the idea is not eternity is already there to be discovered, but it's created in these works. Like when a mathematician finds a new proof that like it's going to be eternal for all time, but it's also a creation. It's this Cartesian idea that creation is linked with eternity. It's not just always there to begin with. So I think when I see a great new work of art or fall in love or this or that, it's like that. It's like you like Spinoza, we know by experience we are eternal. It's not like a pure thought, you know, you experience it and it's unbelievable. So I think that relation to artwork should be defended against all sort of transgression about, oh, you know, there's no masterpieces, it was this, it's that. But when I think of the works really changed my life, yeah, I'm definitely riding for it for eternity. Because then I got a glimpse of the future and I know these works will last. Not on its own, it's because I will have to defend it over and over again. I will have to transmit some of its ideas in my own work. But that's the work of thinking with art. It's not just like, oh, it's great, I'll just keep it to myself. You have to defend it. You have to create an idea around it. You have to continue some of its lessons in your own work, in your own life. Like, that's what makes it an event. It's not just, oh, I claim it and it's great. It's like, it becomes an event because of the consequences I followed, because I think it's an event in my thinking. Oh, it's funny because, like, when I was talking about, like, traditional quality, it doesn't matter if it's good or bad. Yet at the same time, I'm defending the question of the masterpiece, for instance. I mean, perhaps the term is wrong, but I think you know what I'm trying to get at. Like, I just think that it's important that when people try to devalue the term, I feel like either we come up with a new critical term or we just have no terms of evaluation. What are we doing? We're just kind of consuming films and that's it. Like, if I also distrust the sort of indeterminacy that we can just get rid of a bunch of terms and we'll be fine, you know? But I think this link that, let's say, the term masterpiece has with the invention of a new type of tradition, because each time a masterpiece, of course, is added to the set you have in your head, it subtly changes what came before. Like, you'll have a new understanding of a certain film, like a new film comes out, and like the whole idea that it will create its own predecessors, that there's going to be some things in the older works that are new now because this new work brought that out of it. You know, so there's this constant change like that too. And I think we're giving away way too much to just think that there's something evil about the idea of like great works. Whether it's good or bad, I'm more interested in this sort of relationship to thinking and these sort of invented traditions that we can refer to. Because what's nice about art is that, of course, it's radical breakthroughs, but it's also a sort of projected, invented tradition that we could all claim to. Like, I feel no, like, sort of alienation towards the history of cinema. I feel like it all belongs to me. It belongs to anyone else, you know? I like how Serge Denis said, like, cinema is like a supplementary country. And I truly think that I don't feel any sort of distance from any cinemas. And something to value that you could appreciate great works from all these countries. Like, you can't really be a cinephile without being immediately internationalist. That wouldn't make sense. You know? I don't know who's into cinema who just like, oh, I only watch this type of film. And if you do, maybe don't really like cinema. I don't know. But there's something immediately tied to internationalism in cinema too. And I think tying that internationalism to the idea that we can appreciate great, amazing works of art from all these different places already has an implicit universalism that is usually mocked today, but I think is real and worth preserving and recreating, like, new universals too. That is multiple universals, and not to get rid of it.
Yeah, and this goes to, I think, just kind of wrapping up what we were saying before, is maybe some people would have a negative reaction to the transnationality of cinema under the conditions of capitalism, which mean when you go to watch a big budget studio film, it is an international project because the producers are from England, the actors are from Australia, the other actor is French, this person's from Algeria, you know, the camera person is wherever the fuck they're from. And the reason that they're brought together is because of the extent and the reach of the market and the power of capital to be able to realize itself in the expenditure of labor power under the conditions of seeking its own end. So then the idea for inventing the future that's interesting is to flip that.
Oh, totally. Oh, what I mean is, just like, even when Kiarostami makes a film in Iran and everyone's Iranian on set,
right.
It's an international film. You know, it's not so much, oh, you have to get everyone the same thing. It could be just like a food court type multiculturalism. But the idea is that, no, like, even if they're, you know, contingently all Iranian within the project, you watch it, you know what universality looks like. There's no second guessing. You know, I could watch Taste of Cherry and it's not like, oh, no, this is not. No, it's almost the opposite. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, you can watch it on Zoom. You're not like, oh, you know, this is not international. No, it's actually maybe more than most international productions, you know? So,
right.
So it's like, yeah, it's not that simple thing about just like, oh, get enough faces on there. You know, we're good. You know, it's actually, yeah. But again, it's this internationalism is achieved through an idea of form because we see it and we know what that is.
Well said. Well, do you have anything you want to say in conclusion? Any teasers you want to give to anybody that's listening about the film? What can they expect? When can they expect it? I originally said winter, and then all of a sudden you and your team over there are like, no, we're going to have it sooner than that. What can we say to people?
I mean, I'll just say, yeah, you'll see. Yeah.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Basically, yeah.
All right.
You're going to drop it like Kendrick, day of, bam, there you go.
That'll be fun. I mean, if it's a studio picture, it could happen at any moment, right? It's fun. Yeah. We're all working on it. We're all having a good time. So.
Sounds good to me. Well, thanks, brother, for coming on and chatting.
Of course, I had a fun time.
Really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, thanks,
Isaiah. Nice to meet you, Troy.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah, for sure.
So that was Isaiah Medina. He is the director of the film that I've been producing for the last little while. It's the adaptation of Nick Cernik's and Alex Williams' Inventing the Future. We are launching our crowdfunding campaign. It is actually live today, Thursday, April 6th. It'll be going for a month. And we got some badass rewards on there, all kinds of free books. Like literally, dude, Troy, Verso has hooked us up because Verso obviously published Inventing the Future. But they sent me an email a little bit ago and, you know, we've been trying to work out a package for what they would be able to offer. But basically they were like, yeah, we can do tiers where it's like, you know, one tier can be a free copy of Inventing the Future. And then one can be three free eBooks of your choice. It doesn't have to be Inventing the Future, anything. And then another tier is five free eBooks. So basically we have all these bundle packages where for like $35, you get five free eBooks. For like $50, you get an advanced online access to the film Inventing the Future. Plus you get five free eBooks. Plus you get this. Plus you get that. We've got these badass denim jackets. Did you remember the denim jackets that Kanye was wearing that said Pablo on the back?
The ones that say Godard on it?
Yeah, the ones that say Godard on the back.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. That's ridiculous, man.
So you get that bundled with five free eBooks, bundled with hard, and we are actually given got some hardback, or not hardback books, but hard copies. They'll be paperback books, but hard copies of books, but opened up from the entire Verso library. So they have books on art, politics, culture, philosophy, economics. They do novels, books by Ta-Nehisi Coates and Angela Davis, and then Zizek. Oh, nobody likes Zizek anymore, so fuck Zizek, but Rancière and you know, Rosa Luxemburg and Tariq Ali and Owen Jones. I mean, their library is massive. So there are some badass rewards. So check out the crowdfunding campaign. You can go to the website, inventfuturedoc.com, and then there's a button. You can click that and it'll take you straight to the Indiegogo campaign, or you can just go to Indiegogo and search for Inventing the Future. Let's move on, Troy.
Sounds good, man. I'm in on that. But can I get a denim jacket? First of all, can I not get a denim jacket? But just a jacket that has other like avant-garde 60s filmmakers?
I think that's amazing. Like Truffaut.
Can there be a series?
Yeah.
Can I get like Fellini up in this?
Fellatio?
The Fellini Fellatio?
The Fellini Fellatio? Is that a move?
That's a move I heard about, yeah.
It's called the Fellini Fellatio, babe. Don't worry about it. Yeah, I'd be so down for a whole series. So one of the other producers on it, so Isaiah has a team that he's a part of. His production company is called Quantity. It's QTY. And, the co-producer that's on his side of the pond over there in Toronto is Matthias. And he basically made these denim jackets. And so maybe if we petition him, he's only got a limited amount of these jackets. I think there are four of them. Maybe we can get some more made in the future because I think they're fucking rad, dude. I want one.
Yeah, I don't really want full communism unless it has denim jackets.
And you got to rock the double D too, right? You got to have denim, denim jacket and denim jeans.
That's the future that liberals want, right?
That is the future that liberals want. Double D.